to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Andrea and Ron DeFeo, Dr. Robert Peskin, and Dr. Raymond Ellis. High-rise building fires are notable for both their rarity and for the extreme risk that they can present. There have been a number of such fires around the world recently, and the most horrific of which was the June 2017 Grenfell Tower fire in London, in which at least 80 people lost their lives. A contributing factor seems to have been the materials used in the building's facade. To help us understand the connection between building fires and the materials used in construction is Robert E. Solomon. Robert is the Division Manager for Building Fire Protection of the National Fire Protection Association. Robert, thank you for talking with us today.
Sure, glad to be around today.
So can you tell us something about the National Fire Protection Association, what its origins are and its mission?
Sure. So NFPA has been around for quite a while. We were actually founded back in 1896 in Boston. We were organized actually by the insurance companies. And the main purpose for establishing NFPA was actually to develop some standardized rules and regulations surrounding the built environment. So our modern era NFPA is, you know, we have a mission statement like everybody else. We're really kind of devoted to eliminating death, injury, property, as well as economic losses from things like fire, electrical hazards, and we even cover other types of events like emergency preparedness, kind of regardless of what's going on. So at NFPA, we're able to support that through the area I work in. That's through development of codes and standards for the built environment. We have our own research group, including our own research foundation. We provide training and certification programs. And then we also have another sector that kind of reaches out on the public education side that has fire safety messaging and lessons for kindergarten kids and up through high school. So we really kind of try to bring the full suite of things to the fire safety and kind of the hazard issues that are out there.
So kind of full service organization. Do you have your own model codes?
We do, right. We develop about 300 different codes and standards, and we cover the ground from A to Z, from atomic energy to zirconium. So we cover everything from building construction materials, the egress design, the exit design in buildings. We have design standards for things like installation of automatic sprinkler systems and fire alarm systems. The biggest code we actually develop and the one that's most widely used actually is the National Electrical Code, the NEC. So the NEC is used throughout all 50 states, and that governs everything from the electrical wiring that's in your home to the wiring that goes into a 50-story high-rise office building.
So that says that we can expect the same level of protection wherever we go in the United States.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us something about this London Grenfell Tower fire? Is it too soon to talk about it?
There's enough, I think, public information that's out there. And what NFPA has been doing, we've actually been providing a fair amount of information to the media, kind of with those questions, you know, can this happen in the United States? So I always have answered that question. It's unlikely, but we always kind of have to have the asterisk there that there are some things that might go off the rails. But if we kind of take a minute and look at the London fire, first off, we have this existing high-rise building that had a couple of strikes going against it already. So, for example, the building, it was designed and built in about 1974, and in the UK, just like in the U.S., there was no requirement for an automatic sprinkler system in the building, so it didn't have sprinklers. We understand that the building fire alarm system wasn't functioning properly, and therefore the residents apparently weren't able to get the advantage that a fire alarm system would give you in terms of early warning. And then kind of the third strike was the building was designed with a single exit stair. That was almost one of the most surprising things to me. In the U.S., we have kind of moved away from designing, especially high-rise buildings, with single exit stairs in the 1940s. So this building already had some things working against it. And then as part of this remodeling project that came about in 2015, 2016, somebody thought it would be a good idea to kind of dress up the exterior of the building by installing one of these exterior facade systems that we kind of generically refer to as a cladding system. So we have kind of three strikes against the building already, now something has actually been done by the design community, the regulatory community, to just make it that much worse.
So why, I'm curious about the choice of the cladding material. My understanding, it had some degree of inflammability, that if it caught on fire, it was hard to put the fire out.
Exactly. So there are provisions. We have provisions in the U.S. codes, and the U.K. codes have very similar provisions. So we started to see these cladding systems incorporate some type of an exterior insulation component. And the most common system, or one of the most common systems we see used globally, are what referred to as MCM panels, metal composite material panels. So in Grenfell, they installed a version of that, and the MCM panels have a thin aluminum skin. And then there's an insulating core material. In the case of the Grenfell Tower, it was just a PE, a polyethylene foam core material, and then it's sandwiched in between the two pieces of aluminum. So even the U.S. codes, we have provisions to allow something similar, but depending on how high the building goes, then we have a series of fire tests that the panels have to be tested to and approved to. Again, we understand in the U.K. there were similar provisions. So in the case of Grenfell Tower, that type of MCM panel never should have been on that building. And that type of MCM panel, we should never find that on a high-rise building in the United States, with some exceptions and some conditions. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. The other thing that Grenfell did, there was approximately about a 4-inch thick layer of foam core board that was also installed as part of this facade upgrade in 2015-2016. Highly combustible material, relatively easy to ignite, and then once it ignites, just as you saw in the photos, it allowed the fire to kind of run up the building. It allowed the fire to actually melt the aluminum facing and also now allow the polyethylene core and the MCM panel to contribute to the fire growth and spread. So just a very not surprising result, I think, but to see video or to see pictures of a fire not only going up vertically, also surrounding the building, the fire also came down the side of the building, just horrendous footage. And as that's happening now, the fire is also starting to ignite the other apartment units on the upper floors as it's spreading. So just a series of unfortunate things that show that there was, in my opinion, a breakdown somewhere between the design, the engineering community, the contractor community, the regulatory code enforcement community.
So if we looked at the codes in the UK, would the codes presumably preclude this kind of a design?
In theory, they should have. So what we see in the U.S., again, there's some similarities. So in the U.S., these MCM panels, metal composite material panels, we have a couple of sets of rules depending on how tall the building is. So in general, in the U.S., if the building height doesn't go over 40 feet, there's a lot of application to use these MCM panels without this more restrictive NFPA fire test that we'll mention shortly. Once they go over 40 feet in the U.S., then the performance criteria of the panels, it gets ramped up. So now if I'm going to do these MCM panels, in order to pass this fire test, I typically have to use like a mineral core or mineral wool insulating material in between the panels. Much more difficult to ignite. If it does ignite, the fire growth and the spread is very, very minimal. So in the UK, there are some similar requirements and conditions. They have a similar test protocol, but for reasons that I think will come out in the investigation in the UK, those reasons how that material got by all of those layers, the architect, the engineer, the contractor, and then whoever was supposedly doing theoretically plan review or building inspection. So it's just a breakdown on the system. In the U.S. then, once we kind of start to go higher, NFPA has a test protocol. It's referred to simply as the short version as NFPA 285. But the title of that is Fire Test Method for Evaluation of Fire Propagation Characteristics of Exterior Non-Load-Bearing Wall Assemblies Containing Combustible Components. I know that's a mouthful, but we'll just refer to that as NFPA 285. That test is purposely designed to challenge and to test these MCM panel assemblies. And what it does, the test apparatus, it simulates about a two-story structure. We simulate a constructed window opening, and then we challenge that window opening with a burn room burner on the interior that's pushing heat towards the outside of the window. And then we actually have what we call a window burner, and that's a flame that actually directly impinges on the window opening from the outside. So we're trying to challenge the integrity of the MCM panel. We're trying to do everything we can to get it to ignite. And then if it does ignite, we're going to see how far the flame might spread, both horizontally and vertically. So we're doing measurements with thermocouples to look at maximum temperatures on all planes going vertically and horizontally.
So you're doing the testing, is that right?
No. With NFPA, this is kind of all third-party stuff. So the building codes in the U.S., like the International Building Code, would specify when I have to use this test protocol. NFPA then develops the requirements for the test protocol. That's NFPA 285. And then we're going to rely on a third party like Underwriters Laboratories or Southwest Research as an example to actually, if I'm the manufacturer of the panel on this system, I'm going to say, hey, I think I can pass this test. I want to market my material. So now I'm going to go to those labs. I'm going to pay them to run this test for me. So the test protocol is developed by NFPA, but we do not run the test.
So the vendor then, or the manufacturer, can use that as a marketing device, right? That it's certified under NFPA 285.
Exactly, right. In that way, whenever the architect's doing the building design, and they said, we want to up the facade design because, you know, and remember, these MCM panels and these curtain wall designs, as you probably know, I mean, we're doing this for energy efficiency. We're doing it for some weather protection. We're also doing it for some aesthetic look. I think the ACM, the aluminum composite material, that's probably the most common. But, you know, I can use stainless steel, I can use zinc, I can use titanium, I can use copper. So we have some other alternatives. Any of those exterior metal finishes are going to give the building a different look depending on time of day, and I can do some cool things with building illumination at night. So that's exactly it. If I want to make these panels, I want to make sure that they're going to comply with the code, and therefore I'm going to pay to have this NFPA 285 test done to make sure it's safe.
And then if, as an architect or an engineer, I want to specify that for a building design to meet local codes, presumably I have to show that the material does meet NFPA 285?
Exactly, right. That's going to be a condition, you know, again, if I'm using the International Building Code, if I'm using the NFPA Building Code. So in the U.S., this is the thing that we are going to rely on. And when we have all those things in place, then we should never see a Grenfell-type fire occur in the U.S.
And you mentioned, I think, three different building codes. You mentioned NFPA, you mentioned IBC, the International Building Code, and presumably there are local building codes. Are they coincident? Are they overlapping? Are they consistent?
For the most part, there's a fair amount of consistency, but with the codes from ICC and from NFPA, we always refer to them as voluntary codes. So at NFPA, for example, you know, we're a private nonprofit. We have no enforcement authority. So what we do is we serve as the vehicle to pull the right experts together to develop the code requirements. Then individual states or individual jurisdictions can adopt it, and then they always have the right to make amendments at the state level or the local level. So there are some states, and we saw an account that was kind of uncovered by NPR at the end of June, that there were five states that made some amendments to the IBC that actually pulled out the NFPA 285 test criteria for certain configurations. So, you know, that's another one of those asterisk things. In those states, there may be some designs where there might be some materials on some newly designed buildings that may not fully meet the IBC, but, you know, again, the state had the right to make an amendment and to pull out some requirements. So those are some areas where I'm guessing that those states are going to go take a second look at some of those amendments they might have made.
Well, I would presume that the motivation for doing that is to control construction costs?
You know, that is the reason that we heard, and with these MCM panel assemblies, every assembly is going to be a little bit different. So if I test a panel with a certain thickness of, say, aluminum and foam core, and I'm going to put some other insulating material there, maybe sheathed in gypsum board or something, I have to make sure that those individual assemblies are tested. I can't go test the components individually and say component A and component B and component C were tested individually and they pass, and therefore when I put A, B, C together, I'm fine. Because once I start putting the things together, the fire characteristics can change. So the assembly always has to be tested. One of the things that we have heard since Grenfell is owners and even some of the manufacturer of the panels, they said, running that test is going to cost me $30,000. And when you think about where these systems typically go, especially, you know, in where we're most concerned really with these buildings above the 40-foot height, so we're talking in many cases about high-rise buildings, I'm looking at probably a $40 to $50 million building project, and somebody is whimpering about a $30,000 fire test to make the building safe. So to us, it just seems like it is the most pointless argument you could ever make, because I have to spend $30,000 to get a safe product for my $40 million building project. It just doesn't make any sense to us.
I see that doesn't make any sense, but I guess I could reason through that perhaps a building owner or an architect might say, well, it's not just the $30,000 test, but if I fail the test, I may get pushed into using a more costly material.
Well, right, but that's exactly it. I was just at the group of cost engineers in Boston last night. That's what one of the architects said. He said, yeah, I said, these panels that have the fire-resistant foam inner core material, he said, they do cost more. But he said, even when I look at that cost, he said, it might be a dollar a square foot, I think was the number he told the group last night. So even when I start to factor in how much the test is going to cost, and then now how much more it might cost per square foot for the more expensive paneling, it still ends up being a drop in the bucket compared to the overall building cost. And especially when you're talking about a very important safety issue. I don't think there's any architect, engineer, building owner that wants to have their name on something that looks like Grenfell in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a hard one to recover from. What's the performance objective? Have you focused on protecting people or contents, focused on fireproof or fire-resistant, giving people time to get out?
It's really a combination of all of those. The first thing is, if we look at the Grenfell fire, but, you know, certainly we have a petri dish of these fires in the UAE probably over the past 12 years. So when you look at how that fire is spreading up the exterior, one, that becomes a difficult fire for the first responders to try to control and extinguish. So we have to have their safety in mind. We also then are worried about life safety of the building occupants. Now, one of the things that we believe is we've seen different outcomes in the UAE fires. We haven't had any building occupants die, and that's because all those buildings are protected with an automatic sprinkler system. So now I have the fire going up the side. It might want to try to get into one of the living units, one of the occupiable areas, but the sprinkler system has successfully controlled that. So we've seen a different life safety outcome there. And then our third issue to look at is the address hotel is a good example. Things like that become an eyesore and not the kind of thing that Dubai wants to have published all over Fox News or CNN or BBC or whoever it is. So now they have kind of this iconic structure in this otherwise gorgeous urban area that's very modern, that still has the tallest building in the world. And they have they have basically an eyesore there. So from the mission continuity standpoint, it doesn't look good for people that might want to travel to Dubai. And now the address hotel is, you know, lost a lot of room revenue because the whole building is closed down until they can get things repaired and fixed up. So it really is all those things. It's occupant life safety, it's firefighter safety, it's property protection, and it ends up also being important for mission continuity as well.
I understand that the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat has created a working group on fire performance of facades. Is your organization involved in that?
One of our vice presidents is now on that. That caught us a little bit by surprise because we actually have assembled a global team already. We put this group together back in July to go come up with a fire risk assessment tool, primarily to look at how you can evaluate these existing systems on existing buildings. So whenever we saw the announcement from CTBUH, again, which we have a great working relationship with, I've been involved with the group for about 20 years now. We kind of looked at the scope and we said, wow, this is a thing that we started working on in July. So we were able to hook up with our good friend, Mr. Anthony Wood at the council and say, hey, you know, we kind of have this thing going. We think there's going to be some overlap here. And, you know, a lot of what you're looking to do, we are already moving on that with the intent of having this fire risk assessment tool finished up by the end of the year. One of my colleagues, we did get her involved with that group, and then I think we'll be able to provide a lot of support to what that task group is going to do as well.
So your product assessment tool should be done by the end of 2017?
Yes, yes. We put on a bit of a fast track as I mentioned at the beginning, we actually have our own research foundation simply called the Fire Protection Research Foundation, FPRF. In 2014, we actually issued a report that looked at fire hazards of these exterior wall assemblies, you know, that did have the combustible components. And this is something I think that had been building up. You know, we've seen the fires in the UAE probably going back to 2007 or 2008. The fire at the TVCC building in Beijing in 2009, I think, was a really huge eye-opener. That fire occurred in February of 2009, completely wrecked another iconic high-rise structure in Beijing that was scheduled to become occupied in September of 2009. Fortunately, no civilian casualties or serious injuries. They did lose one firefighter in that fire. So when we saw the extent of these, we were kind of scratching our heads like, you know, what is it that people are putting on these? And as we continue to see the fires in the UAE, China, we had a couple of similar fires in the U.S., we kind of flagged that as an issue. So in 2014, our research foundation issued this first report, and there was kind of a recommendation for a phase two follow-up that said, you know, should we look at doing some type of risk assessment tool to help evaluate the existing buildings that are out there. So we really didn't get the traction. There didn't seem to be a lot of interest. And I think everybody was kind of figuring out what had gone on in the UAE and even in China, as well as in the U.S. on these fires. After Grenfell, that issue came back that day. The fire occurred early morning of June 14th. I think by noontime on June 14th, we were back on this report saying, you know, this is kind of what we talked about. How do I evaluate kind of these existing buildings? We got a group together, got that panel together in July. We've had two conference calls now. We actually have a first draft that we all provided some comments on, and the project we have is moving very rapidly. And again, our target is to have this available by the end of the year.
So we'll probably be able to see some notification of that on your website?
Oh, definitely.
Okay. So maybe when that comes out, we'll find a way to get back to you and get a sense of not only the content, but the reaction to this tool. That could be really interesting.
Absolutely, sure. We'd love to do that. In the interim, in the meantime, the other thing that we've done, another tool maybe that your listeners would be interested in, we now have an interactive tool that's online that you can use to go through the IBC or the NFPA building code to determine when I need to apply this NFPA 285 test. When we were developing that tool, we did find some relaxation in the IBC for buildings above that 40-foot height. Those provisions came into the 2012 edition of the International Building Code. And quite frankly, there are some circumstances now where the code would allow me to go unlimited in height with some other conditions with some of these panel systems that don't have to meet the restrictive NFPA 285 test protocol. So that raised some yellow and red flags with us. But the purpose of this online interactive tool is to help an architect or engineer kind of negotiate through the code requirements. We have brief tutorials, we have videos, we've got some great graphics in there as well. So that's something that we can provide a link for that, because that's something available right now.
Okay, very good. Well, we'll make sure we put a link to your website on ours when we post this discussion. Robert, I really appreciate your enlightening us on this very critical issue today, and we look forward to what comes out of NFPA in the coming months.
Great. Okay, well, again, glad to be of assistance, and maybe we can talk towards the end of the year.
That would be really good. Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.